Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soci.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soci. This show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Friends, we got a busy show today, pack full of stuff, but I want to start with something you don't hear every day on a film podcast, but a little bit of audio that was written by Sam Wattemeyer. He is one of the fellow members of the IFJA. He's been on this show as a guest, and I need to get Sam back on the show. I need to get more studio guests back in the studio. That's maybe one of the goals for 2023. But I want to share this up. Sam also does poetry and prose in his spare time, and I want to share this with you because it fits. This is a little bit that Sam has written called Films About Ghosts. Enjoy.
Films About Ghosts by Sam Wattemeyer. The zombie shambles toward us, its cloudy eyes enraged, screaming with hunger. It's the final scene of yet another episode of The Walking Dead, standard viewing for me and my dad on Sunday nights. We indulged in the morbid series religiously, as if we needed another reminder of mortality. In front of the TV, medical monitor cords spread across the carpet like vines on a forest floor. The action of the show punctuated by electronic beeps and boops of medical equipment. I reached for the remote next to the pill bottles on Dad's TV tray. He was sitting on the edge of his home hospital bed in the sick bay that before he was diagnosed with esophageal cancer had been our living room. Dad watched giddily as the not yet undead cast member fled into the forest away from the zombie. He bounced up with delight on the squeaky bed when the end credits rolled. Man, that was a good one. Cathartic, he said. How so? I asked. It's nice to see someone get away in a bad situation. That doesn't happen very often in horror, Dad said. A sly grin lifted the bags under his eyes. I reveled for a moment in the warmth and relief of his smile. It was always soothing to see him without pain. Now felt like as good a time as any to invite Dad to the fall horror convention I was eagerly awaiting. Days of the Dead, held in Noblesville, Indiana. It's the kind of unassuming little place with a quiet town square that a horror director would love to flood with zombies. I was actually reading about that in the paper, Dad said. There's a film showing there that I want you to see. Cool, what movie? You'll see, he said. Another mischievous smile made my father seem like a little boy. Movies energized my dad the same way they invigorate me. His eyes lit up when the chance of going to the theater came around. Even more so after he was diagnosed with cancer. He wasn't completely confined to his bed, but he certainly needed rest. And the depression from his sickness and inability to work undoubtedly played a part in grounding him in that room. But movie-going was something he always looked forward to, and an escape he definitely needed at this time. Fortunately, during this difficult period, my work involved reviewing movies for the local weekly newspaper, Nuvo, which the editors told me meant new voice. Dad would offer to help me find that voice when I sat on his hospital bed after work with my computer and a small stack of film screeners in my lap. I was curious about the film he wanted me to see that weekend. never steered me wrong when it came to movie recommendations. As we left the house for the horror convention, my mother lovingly shook her head, bemused by her two boys' thirst for thrills and chills. On the way to the convention center hotel, Dad's pale face grew flushed with joy as he shared his love of horror films. I'll never forget seeing The Exorcist with your mom. I stayed up that whole night talking about it. Not because I was scared, of course, he said, his dry lips cracking into a wry smile. I was just struck by how it mirrored the mood of the time. It really captured the loss of innocence, the vulnerability of youth. I know it sounds silly, but if you think about it, the little girl possessed by the demon in that movie wasn't terribly different from the kid sent to Vietnam. She was helpless like them. Dark forces were just thrust upon her. This connection between the film's otherworldly story and real-world issues enchanted me like magic. Dad added dimension to The Exorcist Reagan, brought her into his world and made this horror icon a vulnerable Vietnam-era youth like him. She wasn't just a mere invention anymore, but a funhouse mirror of reality. It's therapeutic when you deal with your fears through fantasy. Like Mary Poppins said, a spoonful of sugar helps medicine go down, Dad said with a bashful chuckle. Horror movies kind of exercise the fears that are hurting us. Hell, I wish the priest and the exorcist would come drive out the fear and sickness hurting my dad. That kind of collision between reality and fantasy soon appeared before our eyes. As Dad and I pulled up to the hotel, we saw a line of creatures down the block. Zombies, vampires, werewolves, razor-fingered dream stalkers, you name it. All of them out to celebrate the cathartic power of horror. When I took my eyes off the crowd, I saw Dad smiling from ear to ear. I wished he always felt this good, this comfortable. Walking up to the hotel felt like being in a horror movie. With the soft purple light of dusk behind us and the small town bustling with grisly creatures. We waded through the grim sea. Our noses tingled with the smell of fur, rubber, and corn syrup, which stained several attendees' gory getups. Dad led us through the hotel lobby, walking quickly in front of me, which felt a bit strange. I was growing used to him getting winded and falling behind when we would go anywhere, often removing the breathing tube from his nose out of discomfort and embarrassment. A few people seemed to recognize him as we walked by, darting the "Where do I know you from?" look that is so common at horror conventions. "Here it is. I can't wait for you to see this." Dad's voice squeaked with an edge of adolescent exuberance. We stopped at the screening room, took our seats, the lights went down, the film began. I was a zombie for the FBI. The opening credits sequence alone made my dad seem right at home, reminding him of a more innocent era of horror films. You could sense the actors having fun, like mischievous big brothers, their tongues poking through their cheeks. Dad giggled, like he would at children on Halloween, sitting back more comfortably in his seat than he did in his rickety hospital bed. The film washed over him like a warm blanket. I was a zombie for the FBI. Tells of a quiet little town, much like the one we were visiting. It's invaded by aliens who recruit two thieves to help them steal and poison the local soda supply in order to zombify the population of Pleasantville. As I watched this little black-and-white B-movie, I found myself regretting how often I took movie-going with Dad for granted. I thought about the warmth of his burly arms, which were reduced to sticks by chemo, and his love of cinema radiating. The way he nudged me with surprise snacks during the slow parts of a movie. The way we would often go to a coffee shop afterwards and almost knock our cups over while excitedly talking about films. My brain suddenly snapped back into the horror flick, and I jumped up in my chair to find my daydream colliding with the dream world on screen. My dad was suddenly in the movie. 30 years younger and dressed in old-fashioned detective garb, he was one of the titular FBI agents, speaking urgently about the alien threat. His dialogue seeped through my ears like a zombie's moans. I couldn't make out a word of it in my mystified state. Did that poisoned zombie soda leak out of the screen and into my brain? Was I dreaming? When I turned to Dad, he was already looking at me, smiling. "Pinch me, Dad, this is crazy," I whispered. "It's freaking me out. That guy looks just like you." "It is me," he said, barely containing his signature sly grin. "Why didn't you tell me you were in a horror movie?" I asked, almost yelling. "I wanted to surprise you at the right time." He never failed to surprise me. Even when he was shriveled by sickness, my dad seemed larger than life, especially up on that big screen. After my father's death, I was able to track down a copy of I Was a Zombie for the FBI on DVD. I've not yet watched it. Looking at a picture of my father is one thing. Watching him move is quite another. But it's comforting to know that the film has been digitized. The print we saw in Noblesville will soon begin to decay. But the ones and zeros of the digital conversion will maybe ensure that the film will last forever. I Was a Zombie for the FBI, a campy horror pastiche made by a scrappy crew of film students, has in a way made my father immortal. His voice, his eyes full of mischief, existing forever at 24 frames per second.
That was Films About Ghosts. That was written by Sam Watermeyer, as I mentioned. Read by Jaina Kaylee Kirk. Music and sound design by Brian James Bell. And as Sam writes, this piece is for my brother Harry's film collective, Midnight Monolith. People can read the short story upon which it's based at Midwest Film Journal. So there you go. That's a little bit of writing from my buddy Sam. I hope you enjoyed that. And thank you for letting me be indulgent because, well, all podcasts are indulgent. So salute to you, Sam. Hang in there, buddy. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I'm going to have an interview with Joe Corey, who has written a book recently called 80s Teen Flick Festival Reunion. And we'll talk about our connection with Golden Globus Theater, which is going through Blaxploitation History Month. This week they are discussing Blackula, so we might hear some Blackula music at the end of this week's show. But I want to start with a film that has just gotten into the news this week. The Iranian film No Bears has opened. This is written, directed, and starring Jafar Panahi. Who's been arrested is currently in an Iranian prison for making propaganda films against the government. Well, the filmmaker is now, Jafar has now gone on a hunger strike in prison. That was announced on his wife's social media this week. Known for films like The White Balloon and The Circle, this was a film that was up for Best International Film consideration and is still a solid film. It takes it takes some time to build attention, as if it doesn't already from out of the gate. We have a filmmaker who looks in like, it's basically Jafar playing himself. He is trying to direct a film in Iran that is being filmed in Istanbul. So we get the back and forth between the film and his situation of trying to find a place to direct. As the film goes on, the tension gets ratcheted up, especially in Iran, and it does build up to a certain degree in Turkey. Very tense ending. And this is all for the creative process. The film that is being made is about, as we find out in the opening scene, it is an immigrant who is in a foreign country and not being welcomed with open arms by the locals. So we get to see that blur of fantasy and reality. You know, he's making a feature film, but it's actually happening right now. And, of course, adding meta to it is the fact that Jafar Panahi is in prison and is now going on a hunger strike. There is one of the more tense endings to come out in recent years, without giving away a whole lot of, do you fully commit to your artistic vision and your artistic freedom, or do you get out? And that's kind of, it's almost like yelling at a screen at a horror film, which I'm going to get to in a little bit. But yeah, really well done. And talk about timing, probably not since Happening, when we've had unfortunate or fortunate timing as far as news and what the filmmaker is going through now. So yeah, No Bears. Look, go to your local art house. That is where it's being shown. So look for No Bears, which is now in Indianapolis this week. Shifting gears, I mentioned a horror film. I have to tell you, it's just timing and you know, your own personal taste. I had, for a brief period, the films X and Pearl as in my top 10, because they were both kind of throwbacks to horror films of the 1970s, as far as the style of story and the way it was shot. There's another film that is kind of a throwback to the 70s. I just couldn't latch onto it as much as X and Pearl, and it's called Waking Karma. And it's the story of a mother and a daughter who are survivors of a very dangerous cult. The daughter is now 17 years old, and there's scurries and rumors that the cult leader, a.k.a. her father, is back on the prowl. And then what happens when those rumors start to become true? This is one of those low-budget, you shoot in one location, you have six actors, and that's about it. The big selling point for this is that the father/cult leader is played by Michael Madsen, who shows up about a third of the way through the film, delivering his oozy, dangerous charm that Madsen has been known to do for a long, long time. The film is tense as far as mom and daughter, you know, working together, trying to get out. They go to a compound where there's no Wi-Fi and they can't be found. These are other survivors of the cult, and what happens when the cult comes back to get them. So it's that kind of old school feel. There is a plot twist, which I'm not going to give away, and I couldn't go with it. And I know a lot of people, especially those who like horror films more than I do, will go with it. And I just couldn't. So, and then of course, when that happens, the film can't end enough fast enough for me. So, with an ending of a passing the torch that nobody asked for, well, nobody wanted, and but it's going to happen anyway. So, yeah, Waking Karma, kind of a disappointing evening, unpleasant evening of cinema. But I will say, it did do one thing for me. He says, going through his pages, as you could probably imagine, in my house, there is the never ending pile of DVDs and Blu-rays that I need to go through because they've either been sent to me, I've bought them, whatever, or they've been gifts. And, there's one that has been on the pile for a while. I decided to watch it, especially after watching Waking Karma, which also opens this week, because of Michael Madsen. I had a documentary, well, a mockumentary, actually, called Being Michael Madsen from 2007, and I plopped that in after watching Waking Karma to hopefully cleanse my palate, and it did. Madsen again, he plays himself in this, and this is a mockumentary about what happens when a famous person, a celebrity, tries to turn the tables on the paparazzi. We get Madsen, who obviously has kind of a bad boy reputation, and he's kind of leaned on that, according to his sister, Virginia Madsen, who is So there's some real life folks into this. Virginia Madsen, his mother, their mother, Virginia and Michael's mother, Elaine, David Carradine, Harry Dean Stanton, Daryl Hannah. This is from 2007. So, and then we get the point of views from them, but the eye rolling sister that is Virginia Madsen is a highlight in this. But we have a tabloid paparazzi who helps in a campaign that Madsen may have murdered somebody he had an affair with or somebody he had an encounter with. So Madsen decides to turn the tables and hire three filmmakers to ambush the paparazzi that's bothering him, paparazzi style. And of course, all three filmmakers all disagree on their approach to doing this film. And so, anyway, there's a nice twist as far as Michael Madsen's victim. But Madsen doesn't get to do a whole lot of comedy these days. I know he gets a lot. If you look at his IMDb, a lot of action, a lot of horror, a lot of, intense, brooding, intimidating guy. Kind of yearned for the 90s, but when his career started to take off in the 90s, never forget, this was a guy within the span of a few years was in Thelma & Louise, Reservoir Dogs, Free Willy, all. So, we hopefully we'll get to, but it was nice to see him do comedy in this case and doing it really straight in this film. So, yeah, I thank Walking Karma for this, even though I didn't like the film. It did make me watch Being Michael Madsen, and that was an enjoyable little romp that I needed at that time. So that's what I've been watching. Well, there's a couple others. From Kino Lorber from the mid-80s, there's a film called Ghost Warrior, starring Hinoshi Fujioka, who is a 16th century shogun in Japan, or, shot in California. His attempts to rescue his love, a princess, goes horribly wrong. He falls in frozen water and is dead or just frozen. And a scientist finds, his body is found by hikers. The scientist wants to bring him back to life. He is being thawed out in Los Angeles and brought back to life. We have a cute television reporter, actually not a television, but a cute reporter who trying to do the film noir voiceover, or as I wrote in my notes, the actress, not Karen Allen, somebody cheaper. And what happens when this warrior wakes up? What are the scientists going to do with this? This was an interesting film for me because I had just watched Program to Kill with Sandahl Bergman and Robert Ginty, which is a very similar one of taking somebody and reprogramming them, or in this case, taking a frozen person and bringing them back to life. And what happens when the reporter is trying to ease him into society using the methods of using Japanese culture, letting him have his swords, which, of course, nobody at the hospital wants to have him do. And then what happens when your subject, your ghost warrior, escapes and winds up in modern day Los Angeles in the mid 80s? So this is a pizza and beer film. It's okay. The fight scenes, especially where the ghost warrior rescues a homeless guy being harassed by some really old juvenile delinquents. You know what I mean when you see those. And then there becomes a fight between the local gang, the police, and the escaped subject, the ghost warrior. So yeah, pizza and beer film from Kino Lorber called Ghost Warrior. And finally, from Wellgo USA, before Ip Man, there was the Grand Master of Kung Fu. And this is another throwback to the martial art films of the 1970s, China versus Japan. We have a martial arts school that is being harassed by the Japanese government who wants to bring their style of martial arts to town. There is a tournament, fight between the Chinese representative and the Japanese representative to see who could run the studio, the dojo itself. And so there's that aspect of it. And one of the disciples from the Chinese guard wants to fight and represent. So, and I remember the Japanese-Chinese conflicts from the Bruce Lee films of the 1970s, and it has that look, although a little flashier camera work. Again, this is, for me, you pull the camera back and let me see two guys actually fight. And you get some of that, but not as much to my own taste. What it also helps that the film's only like an hour and 15 minutes. So, but it fits into the genre of fighting for the tournament, fighting for representation, fighting for glory. And what happens when the government kind of sticks its nose into the business of who's running the dojo, and what happens when our hero's wife and son are kidnapped. He has, and they're asking him to throw the fight, which is also kind of a crime noir boxing aspect of American cinema. So, yeah, but check out Welgo USA's release of The Grandmaster of Kung Fu, which is now out on Blu-ray. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. We're going to go around the horn, then we're going to have my interview with Joe Corey, and then we'll grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching this past week. Over at IU Cinema, Friday night, 7 o'clock from 2022, is a part of the International Art House series, Lenore Will Never Die. And then at 10 o'clock for their Not Quite Midnight series, Night of the Comet from 1984. You can also check out Golan Globus's take on Night of the Comet. Check out their show. Saturday, February 4th at 4 o'clock, Lenore Will Never Die. 7 o'clock from 1974, All Screwed Up. And so that's happening on Saturday the 4th. Tuesday, February 7th at 3 o'clock is the IU Cinema Open House. So go check that out. Wednesday, February 8th at 7 o'clock is Skinamarink from 2022. Thursday, February 9th at 7 o'clock is a part of the Staff Select series. Oh, gosh. Zindagi na Miligi Dobara. You can go to cinema.indiana.edu if I mispronounced it. Friday, February 10th at 7 p.m. as part of the International Art House series Decision to Leave. And then at 10 o'clock for Not Quite Midnight series from 2016 with my buddy Jeff Parise in it, The Love Witch, Friday, February 10th. And then Saturday, February 11th at 4 o'clock is Decision to Leave. And then at 7 o'clock, the original 1974 film of Swept Away. And then Tuesday, I'm going to keep going. Tuesday, February 14th at 7 p.m., Mulholland Drive. Thursday, February 16th at 7 p.m., Rear Window. All of that is happening over at IU Cinema. Over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, mark your calendars. Friday and Saturday, February 10th and 11th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Funny Face from 1957. That's a favorite of Mrs. Soce's because it's Audrey Hepburn and a much older Fred Astaire. February 17th and 18th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Moonstruck. And then February 24th and 25th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m. from 1955, All That Heaven Allows. All of that is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Friday and Saturday night at the Can-Can Cinema, The Room with Greg Sestero is happening there. Of course, they're also showing Last Man Fishing, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Women Talking, and Infinity Pool. So all of that is happening over at the Can-Can. All right, friends. I recently had a conversation with Joe Corey, who is a writer and a film guy. You can go online you can check him out as Your Canadian Girlfriend. I got to know Joe because he is a frequent guest on Golan Globus Theater, which I've talked about before. They're doing Blackula this week. And Joe has written a book called 80s Teen Flick Festival Reunion. And it's an 80s movie guide, but it's written like a festival program as opposed to just a dictionary. And I should note now, before the interview, I didn't know there was a second book. So I thought this was the first one. This is actually the second book. So there's my ignorance. But still a fun chat and a look at 80s movies, especially those you don't either remember or you don't immediately associate with the term 80s movies. So, and you should, because there's some really good stuff in here and some fun writing. So anyway, from earlier this week, here's my chat with Joe Corey. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is the author of 80s Teen Flick Festival Reunion, curated by Joe Corey. Joe, how are you?
Doing fine. We're down here in Raleigh, where it is cold and overcast.
Well, we're in Indianapolis, and it's the same thing. So there you go.
It's a unifying thing for America at this point.
Exactly, exactly. So before we get to the book, because I guess we have to mention them first, so we have a connection with Golden Globus Theater. How did they get in touch with you, or vice versa?
I remember just one afternoon, several years ago, and I was like, yeah, I wonder if someone does a podcast about canon movies of all things. And theirs came up immediately, and I started listening to it, and started listening to the old episodes and wrote them, tweeted them, and we tweeted back, and we've been, cyber buddies since then, cyber cinema buddies.
Yep, something like that. Go ahead.
They eventually invited me on to be a guest, which was great because we ended up doing one of the things we did was Death Wish 2, and it turned out I didn't even realize it at the time when I said I want to do that the editor, Julian Simillion, it was one of the guys I worked with at North Carolina School of the Arts.
Oh, wow.
So it gave me an excuse to get a hold of Julian, and he gave me all this horrible background on Death Wish 2 because he was not a big fan of working on the movie, so or director Michael Winner. So it was kind of it was a fascinating way to talk to him and, reconnect.
So. Nice. I was going to ask, besides, what else have you done on the show besides Death Wish 2?
Class of 1984.
Yep.
Episode of canon for Thanksgiving, the Thanksgiving canon episode in my mind.
Yep.
I'm trying to think the other ones, but those are the main ones. I think I'm hopefully coming back soon. I hope.
Yeah. So. I have one lined up for later this month, so I'm excited about
that.
They
always seem to have me on during the week where it's one guest must die. That special month when we're
going to
eliminate somebody. So,
well, and don't worry. You were talking earlier about Michael Winner. There's hardly any good things to be said about Michael Winner ever. So,
you're talking one of your greatest directors who had to sit there probably during the dailies and go, "How can I make this scene more cruel?" I think people might have a little bit. They may not wince as hard as they can in the audience, going, "What the hell is it?" Yeah, it's any Michael Winner film, and there's got to be at least somebody with a story of, and then he just decided to make it more sadistic.
Yeah, and if those listening, if you get a chance to find the Electric Boogaloo documentary, which is about the history of canon films, that was kind of the start for me on, oh, wow, you really went there. Okay, bad guy.
Just, over the top. Self-important. I think my favorite part was being told by Julian that Michael Winner had basically published his own book about his genius.
Oh, jeez.
I almost wonder. Because remember in Mad Men they had that book that Roger would give out.
Yes. Yeah.
Thing. I almost think that's based on Michael Winner's book would give away to people that he felt deserved his genius.
Oh, that very well could be. That's a nice connection. I hadn't thought of that.
I haven't actually found the book. I keep looking for. I poke around, and Julian, I think, had lost his. So, but it's one of those things where you almost want to put the PDF out there on the internet so people could get a horrifying laugh.
Exactly. And before we'll get to the book, I swear. You studied mm-hmm. film in North Carolina.
I went to North Carolina School of the Arts, School of Filmmaking in the late 90s. And you probably know at least three of my classmates. Craig Zobel,
yep.
who did Mare of Easton. And then there was Danny McBride,
uh-huh.
who's gone on to, do a bunch of stuff.
Yep.
And then, of course, David Green, who I guess now calls himself David Gordon Green.
Yep.
We just called him David back then. There was no Gordon. he went on. And I guess, Danny and David have gone on to do those Halloween movies, which for some reason they've got two characters named after me as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, nice.
The first one, I don't know if you remember, the worst and most horrifying and nasty character in all their movies is that podcast guy, the English podcast guy, who just, and they named him, if you look it up online, the character's name is Aaron Joseph -Corey.
Oh, jeez.
So they made sure my whole name was in there, I'm guessing. Uh-huh. I haven't talked to these guys in like 20 years, and no one actually told me about this. I stumbled. Finally, when it showed up on HBO, I decided, let me watch it. And there it was. I'm like, they just called that guy Corey. I looked it up, and I was like, oh, that is me. You bum. And then in the last movie, the second most obnoxious character in the series is a guy named Corey Cunningham, which I guess is me being slammed together with the Cunningham guy who did Friday the 13th and stuff.
Sean
and the
Cunningham,
new kids,
yeah.
Which is in my book. tying it in there. So, but it was hilarious because none of my classmates have said anything about this. Nobody called me up and said, saw the new Halloween. You're in it, aren't you? I think the only other person who gets name checked in the movies is Gary Hawkins, who was I won't say too much, but Gary was one of the more colorful directing teachers at the school, he's Officer Hawkins, the friend of women, which I'm not sure if they're trying to be ironic about that.
Okay.
Because we remember when Gary was Gary did the Rough South of Harry Cruz and Larry Brown, I think that was his big trademark, the Rough South semi autobiographical films.
But, well, your reunions sound like they're fun.
They haven't had any.
and now we know why.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I was one of the associate producers, although it was a small crew, of a movie called Moving Midway.
Mm-hmm.
It's a documentary about this family near here who sell the land that the family's longtime plantation from just barely before the Civil War. They sold the land, so they have to lift the plantation house up, put it on wheels, and drag it about 5 miles away to this other property. And that actually played festivals. It played theaters under normal. First Run put it out, and then ended up on DVD.
All right, cool.
So, I've done that. Plus, I've done my own little indie shows like Danger Health Films with another graduate of the North Carolina School of the Arts, Randy Jones, the cowboy from The Village People.
Okay. Oh, wow. All right. Not Randy Jones, the San Diego Padres pitcher from the 70s.
No,
so.
No, not the man who blew up the bird. was that Randy?
No, it was Randy Johnson. Randy Johnson.
Johnson. That was Randy Johnson. Okay, Randy Jones, I think I slightly remember, too.
No, that's okay. That's a good connection. Wow, that's, yeah. See.
Blowing up birds with pitches, you can't miss, forget that.
That or Can't Stop the Music. We don't know which one's more tragic. Yeah.
Can't stop them. Now Randy did tell me that there was basically when they were making Can't Stop the Music, because it was directed by the woman who played Rhoda's mom,
Nancy Walker. Yeah,
Nancy Walker, and it was shot by Bill Butler, the cinematographer who did Jaws and a whole bunch of other stuff. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bill thought he was supposed to direct the movie,
oh, God.
And he accepted the assignment.
Wow.
So basically, you had dueling directors working the film.
You don't want to argue with Nancy Walker because it could be a TV show or real life and a throat punch.
She's going to come at you with that roll of towels.
That's
know?
Right. Thanks.
You know, that's the thing.
Thanks, so, Alan Carr. Wow.
Yeah, so Randy, we did a show. It's called Danger Health Films, in which we I sat there and broke down. It was the idea of finding the bad lessons in health films that we saw in Ryan High School back then. And, you know, we dug up. My favorite, of course, is a sport which should happen. Basically, agility drunk driving.
Oh, jeez.
Where they would do this on speedways where they would have these people get, you know, in between the races, they would come out, do a couple more hits of beer, get in a car, and try to, you know, do a little, you know, a little swerving course and then fast stopping and trying to pull into their, you know, a driveway and things like, oh, it's hilarious. And, and they actually gave out points and stuff.
Oh, geez. So it's like a drunk version of Death Race 2000.
Pretty much, except without having to run over people.
Oh, that's, well, thank God for that.
But it was, you know, it was there. It was their big way of showing, look, this is why, because, I mean, one of the movies pointed out that the drinking, that you could legally drive when you had your blood alcohol, I think, was 1.5.
Man.
I mean, you know, you had to down a six pack and immediately get in your car to, you know. So it was like, I guess they were trying to let people know it's you got to be less drunk now, you know, to get in your car, please.
There you go.
But, Randy came here. We shot it at my house here in Raleigh, which was hilarious because Randy actually turns out grew up on the other side of the neighborhood. And he comes over and he's just staring, going, I used to play in this neighborhood. And I'm like, yeah, well, we're playing now too. You know, that's the good part 50 years later. But he was, you know, he's a great person. Great,
cool.
You know, and fun to talk to. And the funniest part was finding out that not only did he go to School of the Arts, he's a Moorhead Scholar at UNC.
Oh.
He graduated from there. Which if your audience doesn't know, it's one of the most prestigious. It's considered the American Rhodes Scholarship.
Okay.
The way they work it. It's a very, very prestigious, scholarship. And I sat there looking at it, and all I kept thinking was, when I was a kid, we thought the village people were like these young ruffians they found roaming the blocks.
Well, some blocks, just different blocks.
Here you are. This guy's got this amazing academic career, and it's like, wow. But he reminded me that, you know, if you want to go far in life, wear a loincloth and backup pants and sing for Grace Jones, and things are going to happen for you.
That's words to live by right there.
Dolph Lundgren. Dolph Lundgren happened to him, too.
Oh, my gosh. So where did you get the idea for the book, 80s Teen Flick Festival Reunion?
Well, it came out of having to do something during the lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
I originally was my big plan in that April of 2020 was I was going to go to the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival in Durham, which is a fun 4-day weekend thing, and I was like, was so looking forward to it, and the next thing I get word, it's, you know, everything's shut down.
Yep.
And I'm stuck at home, and I'm like sitting there going, you know, wow, I want to do, I'd love to go to a festival. For some reason, it really bugged me you couldn't go to a movie theater.
Yes.
And then it hit me, hey, I should just make up my own festival. And then it was like, maybe I should make a guide to it.
Yep.
And just do whatever I want. So, you know, and so I just started, first came up with the schedule of what would be the first of the festivals. You know, and it's more Brat Pack oriented. Because I was trying to explain to friends at that time, you know, how these movies interconnect with each other.
Right.
And cast and, you know, other people and stuff and themes. And so it's like, oh, I can put this together. So I came up with the schedule originally, and I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. Because, what's his name? Edgar Wright was, like, doing these double features originally.
Yeah.
This is my double feature for today. And I was like, so I was like, finally, like, yeah, just do it. And then on top of it, I was like, I should do a guidebook. You know, and not just, you know, I'm going to do some summaries of what the movies are about, but just go into odd tangents, either behind-the-scenes stuff I found out or, you know, in some cases, you know, my own personal life trying to see the movie, just anything involving, you know, elements of it. And so, so it's not just a summary of the film.
Correct.
That follows it with each entry. It's, you know, somehow, some way, it's a time capsule of itself. It tries to add context to the film.
And it's more personal because, yeah, you can go to any bookstore and find a guide and, you know, you get this, yeah, like you said, the kind of standard plot and summary. But the fact that it varies from personal experiences or, items that you know, that sort of thing. Actually, before I get to that, what was the last film you saw before lockdown and the first one after lockdown?
Oh, jeez. I'm not sure what the last film was. I know what the event was.
Okay.
I remember it was Joe Bob Briggs came to town with Darcy the Mail Girl, and he did his How the Redneck Saved Hollywood.
Okay.
And that was the last time I was in a huge theater with a crowd, either that or the Cat Festival, one of the two. that was the last time. And then, geez, the first film I saw afterwards – I think I took my kid to go see Princess Mononoke.
Okay.
They were running it locally here. So
cool.
We had discount tickets. So it was like, let's go. We'll risk, you know, being in a crowd. We saw that, you know, the theater wasn't too packed. So, you know,
correct.
Taking it easy.
Okay. So going through this, and what I appreciate is there is more than just the kind of stereotypical 80s movies where, you know, like, you know, I think of Paramount put out some 80s films and it was just an excuse from the repackaged stuff they already put out on video or DVD or Blu-ray, but they put checkered patterns on it and, you know, wacky neon colors. But I loved that you started with Taps, which I got to see in the theater. I was, I think, 12 when that mm-hmm. film came out. And it was one of those... because you're going through, it's not a kid's film and it's not a grown-up film, somewhere kind of in between, and that kind of really surprised me. What was your first experience with Taps?
My first experience with Taps, I guess, would have been just on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was, I remember before it was coming out, and I remember there were a lot of people critical of it because they were like, oh, this is going to turn into some sort of jingoistic, join the military, it's all good, you know, kind of film, and which was funny because, of course, Top Gun was the movie that did that. But this one, you know, but I remember, so I wasn't too hot on going to see it. I grew up in a military family, so I was like, I can live that at home. But I remember seeing HBO and really getting into it because there was something about the kids. It was kind of almost like Yes, with, you know,
right,
the kids taking over and breaking out the weaponry. So, you know, I got involved watching on HBO at that time.
And the other thing I really, really appreciate, and I always tell, especially younger folks, I'm 53, so I was born in 1969. So, there would be, my parents would do the, you know, $20, go see 3 films, we'll pick you up in 6 hours kind of thing. But the films of Essie Hinton meant more to me than the suburban fairy tales of John Hughes. And they also got to me first. So the fact that you cover the films based on Essie Hinton novels, which had a profound effect because it was looking at the other side of the tracks in my case. The fact that you had the same director do 2 books in entirely different ways,
mm-hmm.
And also operatic. I always considered Coppola kind of an operatic director. And you have... I love your installment of The Outsiders because it's always because you have this generation of up and coming actors, but there was already one established person who was a singer and an actor and really kind of stuck out, not necessarily a sore thumb, but just an odd thumb in Leif Garrett.
Leif was, yeah. I mean, you know, even when the film came out, you're like, Leif Garrett's in it. What's he doing in it? You know, kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah.
Because by then he was toxic already. So, you know, with the guy dying, or not dying in the car wreck, but getting injured in his car wreck when he was messed up.
Mm-hmm.
But I found it, well, and part of The Outsiders, the essay there, it relates back to, I ran into him one night at a Hooters at the airport. And it was the
wow.
strangest moment. We just, you know, he was such a likable guy. You know, because all, you know, and this was after VH1, Behind the Music and stuff.
Okay, yeah.
And what happened was there was this touring, like, you know, teen heartthrob series, you know, that was going around, and it had the oldest brother from the Brady Bunch,
Greg Williams,
Barry,
yeah, or Barry Williams, there. Barry Williams, sorry, yeah, Greg Brady, yeah,
Greg Brady, and then they had Barry Williams, yeah,
yep.
And then they had one of the guys from the Bay City Rollers who lied to me. Because he's singing, we had no idea. We start talking because I interviewed Chuck McCann, who he had done a Sid and Marty Krofft show,
yep.
Far Out Space Nuts, and I was brought up. You know, I said, "Whoa, so what was it like doing the Krofft show?" You know, because I remember the Bay City Rollers had their 1-hour Krofft special Saturday
yep.
morning show when everything was falling apart for them. And he tells me kind of, "Oh, that was great," blah blah blah, and then I go online afterwards and discover this guy wasn't a member at that point. And I was like, what the hell, man?
Oh, man.
You know, but he, but the biggest thing was getting to meet, because at some point we, you know, because at least the basic roller guy, you know, next thing I know, it's like, oh, do you want to meet Leif Garrett? I'm like, sure, you know, figuring he's not going to come, but whatever. And Leif comes out and we just started talking and, you know, he was talking about odd things he was up to and stuff, and then out of the blue he gets his guitarist and they do an acoustic version of Neil Young's Old Man, because we were talking about him, you know, meeting up with his dad again, and it was very nice, and he was a very great guy, and unfortunately I wrote it up, I was doing a thing for I think at that point it was still Kevin Kevin Smith's Quick Stop Entertainment website.
Okay.
And I told him I write for him. And I did a little write-up of just running into the airport. It was not nice. And next thing you know, and I sent a copy to, I think his website or whatever. Next thing you know, I get this horrifying screech from his publicist, who's upset because I ambush interviewed her clients and stuff. And I was like, you know. And, you know, it's not even like I revealed, because one of the things he told us at the time was a story about him and Michael Jackson at the Montreux, at some festival in Montreux. When they were both younger, and I left Michael Jackson's name off, and I figured that was going to get me in trouble if I printed that. But this one was just not happy. So it was a strange thing. But the Leif itself was fantastic. But you know, as I said, in the Outsiders movie, he's the troubled person of all those actors.
Yeah,
which you don't think about it. You don't think about Bob the Soj being that compared to everybody else in the film, mm-hmm. you know, all these young stars. And it's like, he's the supernova that all these young stars, it was almost like a Scared Straight episode, I would guess. It was like, here's a warning. If you go out and you party too hard and you don't have a designated driver and, you know, and you're doing all this other horrible stuff, this is where you could be, is him, you know, pleading for Francis to give him to play the villain in a movie. You know, and so, you rarely do look at that. You know, we look at everybody else, Tom Cruise, Emilio Estevez, Swayze, Matt Dillon, all these guys. And then you're like, and there's Leif.
Yeah.
Leif has that strange, he's really supposed to be the clean, happy, preppy guy. There's darkness to Leif.
Yep. And it worked.
It did. And I want to point out, when I did the S.E. Hinton films, before I even did the S.E. Hinton, after I watched the movies, I decided to go to the library and I checked out all the books. There's probably some, you know, junior high kid furious that I delayed their reading of required reading by 2 weeks. But and I didn't realize at the time that all four books are interconnected.
Okay.
You don't know, you know, like that was then, this is now, is in fact the sequel to The Outsiders.
Hmm.
But we don't think of it because it's a totally different movie, because, you know, Emilio Estevez made it years later, had to make it modern, and had to, you know, and because I guess Coppola had the rights to certain characters, there was no Pony Boy. In the book, Pony Boy is the character.
Okay. He's
back. And, you know, it's strange to see these interlacings. And, you know, there's a bit of an overlap between the Outsiders and Rumblefish.
Okay.
And what really got me was, especially with Rumblefish, because I remember sitting there when I was a kid watching, or not a kid, I was in college at that point when it came out. You know, Rumblefish, and it's, you know, black and white, kind of artsy and floaty. Yep. And stuff. And then at first you're thinking it's all Coppola. It has to be. He's Mr. Cinema, right? And then you read the book and you realize this is how S.E. Hinton wrote the book.
Oh, I didn't know that. Did not know that.
Yeah, he captured what she wrote.
Man.
And so it's kind of a, you know, so, you know, that's part of, you know, what you don't think about, but that's there. You know, it's not him forcing his stuff. It's him bringing it out of the page.
Wow.
So, you know, it's one of those films worth revisiting, definitely.
I was really happy when Rumblefish got the Criterion treatment, and I know that The Outsiders has the complete novel. I have both versions on disc because I'm that guy, but yeah, it was great when my kid, who's now in college, got to watch The Outsiders when they were in their early double digits. So the book is called 80s Teen Flick Festival Reunion. I'm here with Joe Corey. What were some of the films that you cover in the book that that had strong impressions on you when you first saw them?
I would say, you know, the main ones that I remember, Whiskey Business.
Mhm.
And what's interesting, cuz I mean, that was, you know, I remember that was out, you know, that was one of the big things when I showed up at college. And, you know, it was that film. You're going to go see Risky Business, or you're going to get the I remember, we'd get when you'd rent the VCR, a group of us would rent the VCR for the weekend. It'd be like one of the tapes that somebody would have to rent, It's a risky business. And, it was such an impact of a film because it was, this kid going to go to college and getting to have a weekend without his folks around and just how bad things, weird things. It was like the Cat in the Hat for people with, people with libidos is the best way to describe the book. Because at the end of the thing, they try to fix the house and put it all back together again. So, mom doesn't know what we're up to. But what struck me about going back and watching Risky Business was discovering that the Blu-ray had the original director's cut when he submitted it, which is so different from the experience that, we've been having all these years where not to give away the ending film, but it's kind of a little joke happy sitcom-y ending.
Okay.
And in the director's cut, you discover that Joel has become the pimp.
Mm.
That he gets her to come. It's the restaurant scene. It ends in the restaurant. They don't go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
But he gets her to come over and sit on his lap in the middle of this restaurant with all these people around. It's like, I am your world, he's telling her. And it's totally different. And it works so well. But I get the idea. And it's easy to know that, it's a perfect ending to this film. It is the ideal ending. And it would have been box office poison.
Yeah, very.
Because I can't imagine anybody taking a date to this. It'd be like I accidentally took a date to The Accused. It's like, we're gonna go away now. Bye.
Oh man,
like, you've taken me to a pimp movie. It's like unapologetic pimp movie, but instead you get the ending that it is now. It's just happy go lucky kind of goofy jokes, and we pan away and have the whole the little speech about what he does.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you mentioned it. I co-curated the dorm weekly dorm screenings like on the weekends for those who didn't have plans, and my cohort, a female, we picked The Accused because it was up for an award, and I wound up being the one there. So when the scene in question happens more than once in flashback, the majority of the audience, female, turned and glared at me. not my favorite moment as a guy sharing films to people.
No, it's funny. I was at one point I was trying to do a piece for John Pearson's Split Screen show that used to run on IFC. I did a couple of them, and one of the ones we were trying to do was the top 10 worst indie date movies.
Ooh.
And that was up there. Was up there. Having experienced it myself, it was like, it's a great, powerful film, but it's definitely not one where you go, and now let's go get drinks.
Yep.
It went up there with Love and Human Remains for me.
Bad Lieutenant. Oh, that's bad, yeah. Oh, God. Too. Well, you have to learn the hard way. At least certain film nerds of a certain era, you just don't introduce this early in a relationship. I know you think it's a great film. We've all had the horrendous first date films. I had a buddy who took a first date to Platoon. I learned Taxi Driver is not good to show early in a relationship, and I showed it to two different girlfriends.
Wow.
So,
that's playing with danger.
That's very danger.
I made the mistake, I was an English major at North Carolina State University, and I made the mistake of loaning my copies of Naked Lunch out to women I was seeing.
Oh, man.
A, relationships ended. B, book never came back.
Wow. Okay, so of the films that are curated in your book, is there ones that you had not seen when they initially came out?
Ocean Stakes.
Oh, wow.
It's the bizarrest of films. Actually, it's in the first book. There's two books. The first book is more, as I said, more Brat Packy, and the second book is the Essie Hinton and horror. The two main things in that one.
Okay.
And James Spader.
Yes, James Spader Knight. That's always before. Yeah.
But yeah, no. Ocean Stigs is one of these films. Tim Sumner used to mention it occasionally, and I'd be like, "What are you talking about?" And I finally got a hold of a copy of it.
Yep.
Because, I mean, it's a movie that sat – it's to give your readers a little bit of background –
no, I know what you mean. Robert Altman in the 80s, which is just an odd decade.
Robert Altman and the National Lampoon in the 80s.
Yeah.
It was a National Lampoon. These two characters, which National Lampoon, one of the guys, writers at National Lampoon had created, who had ended up taking over the magazine, an episode of the magazine, for what turned into the basis of the movie. And yeah, Robert Altman wanted to do a teen flick, and it made sense because that's where he started doing 50s teen flicks.
Yeah.
So it kind of made sense, except Robert Altman was, I believe, not to spread rumors, had to go into rehab after he finished the first cut of the film, as he realized just how out of control he had become. And the film itself sat on the shelf for years, and then it kind of got snuck released.
Yep.
For whatever purposes, and I mean, even now, I mean, the copy I was able to get a hold of it was an MGM DVD, but it was a really bad transfer. It was so it's tiny in the screen because it's not fully anamorphic or anything. So it's, but somehow the weirdness shines through.
yeah, that was. It's funny. If you listen to a Robert Altman commentary track, he will gripe about teenagers because they're the core audience now. Maybe part of it from after trying to make a teenage film himself, but taking a break from filming plays. So that's Altman in the '80s. So you say there's another book, which now I have to bother about getting. I have to bug you about getting that sometime.
I'll send you up a copy.
Okay, because there are two titles I'm going through in this that didn't make it, so I'm wondering if they made the cut on the other book, River's Edge and Losing It.
Yes and yes.
Hey, ding, ding, ding. Okay, all right.
River's Edge is part of it's in there because it's part of Ione Sky Night.
Yeah.
They have a night of Ione Sky movies.
As one should have.
We should. I mean, she was the new sweetheart at the end of the 80s.
Yep.
And, the three films that ran that night,
Say Anything.
Say Anything, and the Rachel Papers.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, which oddly enough, the Rachel Papers is kind of like Say Anything, because she ends up in England. except somehow John Cusack got turned into James Spader.
There's punchlines there. We can do that.
There is. Although I did find out this is the interesting part because we did James Spader weekend in the second book.
Yeah.
Or night in the second book. I had no idea he was best pals with JFK Jr. And they both went to the same posh school together.
Makes sense.
And but it was that weird feeling that if JFK Jr. had lived, would James Spader be our vice president?
Oh my!
You know, it can happen.
It could happen. Know? Oh jeez!
And it should have. It should have. We should have had Vice President James Spader at some point in life.
But bullet-headed James Spader, as opposed to feathered-haired James Spader.
Yeah. Well, he had the most beautiful hair. That was the thing. I think the movie that that really introduced him, Endless Love.
Oh gosh, yes.
Where he plays Brooke Shields' brother. And not the boyfriend.
No, no.
And I think he couldn't play the boyfriend because we as an audience would have been too busy admiring his beautiful angelic hair.
Yeah.
Next to Brooke Shields that we'd go, I can't believe he, maybe he's got an excuse for being so psychotic. You know, it's like...
Yeah, that, I mean that's
her brother.
He had the best hair in that. That also requires wanting to set a house on fire over Brooke Shields.
And the best part was, who tells him to set the house on fire?
Tom Cruise.
There
was Tom Cruise. That's right. Because he had a blip part in it.
That was it. That was his only scene. Was telling him the story about the guy who set the person's
house
on
fire. That's right.
You should try that. Bam. But yeah. And I mean, that's what makes these 80s movies so amazing. You see this entire generation of actors that were getting these parts.
Yep.
And that they're still around.
The other one for me is, I don't know if it qualifies it, but it does for me, but Barry Levinson's Diner.
Steiner is not in there.
I know, but that's another one as far as a – you can make a band poster of the cast of Diner and the cast of The Outsiders and have that kind of intertwining, you know, tree roots of everybody working together.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the Diner – and then, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yep.
Had a fantastic cast that just kept going. I mean, it's – you know, some of these films, they just had these people and they, you know, they were getting – roles all over the place because they're. I mean, what blew me away when I first started doing this was, you know, realizing because we've narrow-minded 80s teen films down to, did John Hughes direct it, right?
Yes.
And that's it. It's and you realize that there are, you know, I'm about to do a third book.
Okay.
Which is going to be, you know, a third festival, which is just deep cuts.
Cool.
You know, movies that we saw, you know, a couple, but, you know, movies that ran on things like USA's Up All Night or just played, you know, they we almost forget they existed.
Love that.
You know, and plus you get, you know, great films like Hamburger, Hot Dog. Who did they make films? You know, you get food movie. No one made French Fry the movie, oddly enough, at that point.
No, they did not. Recast as Palm Frites in Canada and France.
Probably, or poutine.
Or poutine.
I guess you could combine it with gravy.
I'm sure somebody made poutine the movie because the tax write-offs up in Canada.
There's got to be. There's got to be somebody who, middle of, you know, negative 5 degrees in Montreal, shot that movie right when they let the tax deal go through.
We could check the Ken Exploitation website. And, of course, you are a Canadian girlfriend, so you got that going for you.
I'll have to. Yes, that is the secret identity.
So also in the book, friends, when you get this, is I really enjoy the research that you do on the soundtracks because most of these are going to be really hard to find. Do you have a favorite?
Soundtrack-wise? You know what? Vision Quest became one.
Okay.
I really enjoyed the Vision Quest soundtrack. And I think, you know, I think it's underrated. You rarely hear people talk about it. But, it's got such great tune. You know, it's besides two Madonna tunes.
That's right.
You know, and then you get, all the other stuff that they got put into it. I think the Risky Business soundtrack, too, although it's mostly just, you know, good mood music to cruise by.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my favorite soundtrack memory is Youngblood, because that was the first time I ever saw a cutout CD.
Oh, okay.
Music.
Yeah.
I'd never seen someone try to do a cutout CD. But yeah, Vision Quest. You got, you get Red Rider. You get Red Rider's Lunatic Fringe, Sammy Hagar's I'll Never Fall in Love, Foreigner's Hot Blooded. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a perfect little soundtrack.
Nice.
You know, and I think it gets. And once again, you know, what's funny though, because people always talk about John Hughes soundtracks.
Yeah.
You know, and you realize that they weren't, you know, at least the early films, you know. There wasn't much soundtrack.
Nope.
I mean, there is no soundtrack to Ferris Bueller's Day Off because, you know, it's just an odd collection of stuff.
It is, and I wondered if somebody would try to do a compilation, but I think getting the rights to everything, especially now, would just be a huge headache.
Well, I think that, well, nowadays it's just people who do a playlist.
Yeah, they do.
You know, we ignore any of that, and that's the sad part. I realize that, you know, when you in the 80s, it seemed like a percentage of the time you discovered a film was coming out and whether you wanted to go or not, because you'd see the soundtrack being sold at, you know, Record Bar, Camelot.
Yep.
And they would have posters up for it.
Yep. And MTV at that time, because they needed to fill 24 hours, would give you a video of, you know, clips of the movie incorporated with the band. You know, one of my favorites, and it's hard to find, was a piece of music they did for Amadeus, but they incorporated a few scenes of showing Mozart as a rock star mixed in with Kiss, Madonna, Van Halen, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. No, they did that. A perfect example of a film that completely used MTV to its maximum potential is Footloose.
Yeah.
Which had two number one songs and videos in rotation before the movie, right when the movie came out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the theme Footloose, and then Let's Hear It for the Boy.
That's right.
And so, you know, if you're at home watching MTV, and why wouldn't you? And, you know, in the 80s, you know, you were staring at 4 minutes of Footloose, you know, popping up each time they played Kenny Loggins.
Yep.
You know, and it was a big thing. It was, you know, you figure out how much money it would cost to pay for 4 minutes of time on a cable channel nowadays.
Exactly.
And there you are getting it for free, basically. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they were showing clips, showing this. And, of course, coming up, Footloose. Have you seen Footloose? And so, you know, MTV became this wonderful tool for, you know, selling your movie. You know, it's like the first words out of anybody's mouth was, well, we're going to do a video, so it'll be on MTV.
Yep.
You know, and you didn't have to have the band performing. You just had, or clips, although my favorite weirdness factor, and it kind of ruined the film, was St. Elmo's Fire. The John Parr song and video. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Because it has the kid, it has all the Brat Pack people roaming around a burned out St. Elmo's Fire bar. And so when I went to go see the movie, the entire time I'm sitting there, I'm going, when is the bar going to burn down? Where is the burning bar scene? And I don't mean to spoil it. There is no burning bar. It never catches fire. There is no. And you're just sitting, because the worst part about the film is all those characters are so despicable.
Terrible. Nasty. Absolutely terrible people. Yeah.
You want to see them in a tragedy of sorts.
Or a Darren Aronofsky film.
I think the best way to put it was if it was a movie that was waiting for the serial killer to show up. The audience would have cheered if they'd heard somebody trying to start up a chainsaw in the background. You know, it's like, yes, finally.
Go ahead.
Even the super sensitive thing, they had that whole fixation on Woody Allen.
Yeah,
and now we know how horrible that was. You know, like, I mean, if there's anything in the '80s that I could take back, it's the Woody Allen desire. You know, like, no, don't do Woody Allen stuff. I took dates to Woody Allen films; he never worked.
Yes,
I took a date to Waterworld; worked. Okay, you know, it's like Kevin Costner better than Woody Allen. You know, and I know it's a horrible thing to think, but yeah, it was true. It was like. You know, but yeah, that movie was just, as I said, cinema as far as the video, you just wanted to see the place catch fire and just, you know, I want to see, you know, Rob Lowe running around with his arms ablaze.
You know, and with film theory and film comment, and it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. So it's a long game on that. Was curious, and not suggesting anything for your book, but it just made me think of it, of, you know, there could be a section on filmmakers who started out in videos, you know, your David Finchers and those folks, as opposed to, you know, Sam Peckinpah doing a Julian Lennon video as his last piece of work.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the thing was you need to find, well, especially then, you had to find excuses why you could play with the toys.
Yep.
And a video afforded you the ability to go, yes, let's get these camera lenses. Let's do this. Let me try these techniques out. Mm-hmm. You know, and it works to a certain degree that, you know, you're able to pull in the video. You know, I was watching Dawn of the Dead the other day, because I had no idea where Zack Snyder really came from, since that was his first film, the remake.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, I looked it up, and it was like, oh, Zack did a lot of music videos and commercials. And I'm
shocking.
Like, well, that makes sense now that I see how many close-up shots of cigarette butts hitting the floor he shot. You know, it's like, that's it. And also you do commercials. I mean, that's, as I said, because you got to get the toys. You got to get money in. I worked on a commercial with Coach K that was shot by Earl Morris. Saw Earl. Earl is sitting there. He's got, like, five cameras he is renting. It was the American Express ad that Coach K had done years ago.
Okay.
And, you know, they had this giant lamp that they had to bring in and you know, scissor it up so it was outside Cameron so it would simulate the sun coming through because it was just this nasty overcast day. And I'm thinking, you know, Earl Morris probably had a larger production budget for rendering equipment and stuff that one day than all his movies combined.
Man.
You know, I don't think he was able to rent giant, you know, a giant light to go shoot Thin Blue Line, you know.
No.
It's like, but yeah, you do, yeah, as I said, you got a lot of people who come. That's, you know, And you almost would like to see a festival like that where you show samples of what they did before the movie started.
Now, did Coach Case chew anybody out Christian Bale style for getting in his eye line?
No, no. Coach K was, he was a sweetheart. He actually, it was kind of funny because my dad also went to West Point.
Okay.
And he was there. We think dad might have, hazed K as a plebe. Made him sweat pennies to the wall or something that they used to do back then. But it was funny because dad was involved in this infamous incident, which nobody knew who did it, which I can't go into because I think they're still pending charges or something.
Okay.
But I told Coach K's wife about it. And the next thing you know, about 5 minutes later, K comes up to me and goes, "That was your dad?" And I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "Impressive." And it hurt. Right when K got hired to come down, he was the coach at West Point, the basketball coach. He was coming to Duke. And my dad was friends with the hockey coach, Jack Riley, the hockey coach up there. And he tells my dad, tells him, "Hey, when you guys get back to Raleigh, call K's office, tell him who you are, tell him I said call you, and he'll hook you up. Don't worry, we'll get tickets." Dad never made the phone call. And all I kept thinking was, my life would have been so much different if you'd made that phone call. It's like K was impressed by what you did. So
nice.
Always remember, kids, when people tell you to call somebody, you should call.
Yep, exactly.
But yeah, that's K didn't chew anybody out. I've done a bunch of commercials. I never actually had somebody go nuts.
That's good.
The good part was shooting the K one was I walked away with like two cases of Red Bull for some reason. They're like, "Take them." I was like, "Okay." The person working the craft service table. Filmmaking is all about taking home as much as you can off the craft service table.
I was a driver for the Chicago Film Festival back in 95, and my last day, I turned in the car, and I turned in my keys and the paperwork, and there was a case of Modelo, and the guy said, "You want to take it home?" And it's the one and only time I hauled a case of beer on the subway.
There you go.
But your hands are, all red from the grip, but no, I didn't care. I didn't have to buy beer for a week. So
yeah, it's a fun way to live.
Yeah, when you're young. So
when you're young, after that, you can't quite give a case of beer to the kids. So.
Nope, afraid not.
You gotta be more oriented towards what can the rest of the family eat now.
Yep. The book is called 80s Teen Flick Festival Reunion by Joe Corey. Joe, where can people go to find the book? Where can people find you on social media? And this has been a lot of fun.
Oh, great. The books are the two books, 80s Teen Flick Festival and then Reunion, and then 80s Teen Flick Festival, the first one. They're on Amazon. So they're available anywhere you go on the internet, I guess, is the best way to put it. As I said, they're set up so you could play at home, rent the films or find them, stream them online and follow along. Or you can just take your time. But, thank you so much. And thanks. And if you want to reach me, I guess the best place to reach me is my wonderful secret name at Your Canadian GF, like Your Canadian Girlfriend, on Twitter.
All right.
Is the best way to track me down.
Very good. Thank you, Joe.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. And then hello to the folks in Indianapolis.
Yep. That's Joe Corey, the author of 80s Teen Flick Festival Reunion. So go look up for Joe Corey's work. And I hope I'm getting a copy of the other book first. So anyway, we'll get to that. So thank you, Joe. And once again, check him out on Golden Globus Theater, as well as regular episodes of Golden Globus Theater, like Blackula, which is happening this week. Next week is Trick Baby. Later in the month, I will be on as a guest to talk about Detroit 9000. So we'll get to that. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. Hopefully you've been able to watch some good movies that are new or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. We start with Jamie, who writes The Lorax and The Princess and the Frog. Ah, Dee Dee, by the way, drinks with Dee Dee Servino. I'm a guest on it this week. We were talking Brady's and wound up really not talking about 80 for Brady. We wound up talking about one of the actors who's in that film. You kind of know where that goes. Anyway, Dee Dee watched the film San Francisco. Roxana writes, finally catching up on Don't Worry, Darling and Everything Everywhere All at Once. I hope you watch the films in that order, Rox, because the other way around is, oof. Kimberly refers to, well, Kimberly just writes very odd movie, but I don't know which one she's talking about. So, obviously, I think Everything Everywhere is the better film. Don't Worry, Darling. If you enjoy The Stepford Wives Meets The Truman Show, there you go. Eric writes, first views, After Sun, Armageddon Time, and Ida Lupino's The Hitchhiker. His rewatches, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Sink the Bismarck from 1960, which I last saw as I was about to start sixth grade. So, you know, a long time ago. Thank you, Eric. Another Eric, different Eric, writes Buried Child with Ed Harris. Al writes, I saw part of the play Arcadia through a backstage monitor. Does that count? Not quite. Amanda, who I got to see at the Phoenix this week. She went to the library this week. Groundhog Day, a lot of people are watching that. The series The Offer, This Christmas Card. Okay, thank you, Amanda. Britt writes, she said, Shotgun Wedding and You People. Jean writes, Arrival and Banshees of Inisherin. Thank you, Jean. Lisa writes, Lunana and a Yak in the Classroom. David writes, Sin City and Operation Mincemeat. Austin Thomas Glidden of Medium Cool Podcast. Go check it out this week. Was it this? Yeah, this week. You can hear Joe Shearer and Austin and I discussing our top films of the year. For Austin this week, Stutz, Senior, After Sun, The Whale, Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Pale Blue Eyes, Funny Pages, Strawberry Mansion, Pearl, The Northman, Bodies, 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 Megan, Infinity Pool, and The 400 Blows. Or as a certain substitute teacher likes to call the film, Mithrigan. Thank you, Austin. Helen writes Tick Tick Boom, Jennifer's Body, and Singing in the Rain. Marianne writes The Smartest Guys in the Room twice. Molly writes Don't Worry, Darling, Last Night in Soho. Oh my God, so good, as she writes. The Pez Outlaw, The French Dispatch, The Martha Mitchell Effect, and No Time to Die. Nancy writes, Triangle of Sadness, what a completely unexpected film. Loved it. All Quiet on the Western Front, very well done, and sad. And then added, I started Top Gun Maverick and turned it off after a few minutes. I'll give it another try this weekend. And that happens, Nancy. I think I've reached an age where I'm looking at the clock in the evening. I'm like, can I start a film now? Do I have the energy for this? Kristen writes, The Menu, very dark and funny. Kevin writes The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. Jennifer writes, finally watched Everything Everywhere All at Once and really liked it. Saw Banshees 2 and thought it was so well done. Rebecca writes The Booksellers, a 2019 documentary. It's available on Amazon Prime, apparently. John writes, I finished The Sopranos again and now back through Boardwalk Empire, so I'm slacking in my movie watching. Yes, you are, John, but do what you got to do. Kevin writes Tar and Moneyball. Wayne writes, rewatched Everything Everywhere All at Once and Four Rooms. Watched To Leslie. All highly recommended. Thank you, Wayne. Taylor writes Amsterdam, The Pale Blue Eye, Mr. Right, and Them. Oh, Brian. Yes, thank you, Brian. I had posted a picture of Lucy Liu from Kill Bill, and Brian writes, I thought of this scene as soon as you posted about watching Lady Snowblood. Yeah, that was the other thing I forgot to mention in my notes because I didn't write them down. I currently finished both Lady Snowblood films, which are on Criterion. The first one is great, and this the first film is the inspiration for the plot of Kill Bill, of a woman who is avenging the daughter of the woman who was raped and pregnated and wronged, and the daughter. Anyway, it's, and especially the snow, the sword scenes and the snow, that's totally from Lady Snowblood. There is a sequel, which is good, not as good as Lady Snowblood. I'm currently going through, and I finished the six films of Lone Wolf and Cub, which is also out on Criterion. Probably American audiences know it as Shogun Assassin, which was basically the first two films kind of spliced together, but it is a wandering samurai warrior and his son in his much weapon-loaded wooden pram. It's really well, like this one, like Snowblood, really well done, just slashing and blood splurting, which was a big deal in the early 70s. And especially in Japan, you didn't see a blood splatter like that. And anyway, I'm going through the special features of Lone Wolf and Cub and just happy to go through those. It's kind of a cleanse your palate after the Academy Award nominated stuff. So thank you, Brian. Good to see you. Give my love to Monica and BB. Jennifer writes Babylon. Gary writes Breach, Avatar, Billy the Kid versus Dracula. Whew, Journey to the Beginning of Time, Invention for Destruction, Bambi, Class of 1984, and Fireball Jungle. Jeff writes Babylon and the Good Nurse. Ken writes, if you've missed the first three stories of Accused on television, you are missing out. Some of the best since Studio Playhouse. All right. Terry writes The Green Fog, Accidents, The Rabbit Hunters, Stump the Guesser, and Hellbound Train. Somebody's been on a Guy Madden stretch recently. Melissa writes, finally got caught up in Lost in Translation. I'd love to know what you think of it, Melissa, so let me know. Mario writes The Red Shoes. Jessica writes Modern Persuasion. Kurt, who you can hear in Drinks with Dee Dee. We watched Rudy at the Beltrace Saturday night at the movies event. Rudy has a screenwriter from Bloomington. Yes, Angelo Pizzo. So he's been on the show long, long time ago. JJ writes, we watched The Mist, The Dinner, and You People, which JJ referred to as messy, but a better than usual Netflix diversion. Missy writes 42, Midnight Cowboy, Gleason, and American Gigolo. Eric writes Wakanda Forever. Tom writes Planet of the Vampires, Greyhound, The Paper Chase, and Devotion, and then added My Brain Hurts. Yes, Tom, put in, Lone Wolf and Cub. That'll cleanse your palate. Richard writes Hitsville, USA, and Midnight in Paris. Brent writes Banshees of Inisherin. If you see me on the street, I'll explain that. Anne writes Triangle of Sadness. Holy bleep, what a movie. Yeah, that's a Best Picture nominee. So, from the maker of The Square. Whew. Rachel writes That Darn Cat and the Ghosts of Buzzley Hall. Nick Rogers writes Matinee, Excalibur, Shotgun Wedding, You People, Knock at the Cabin, and Missing, 2023 version. Well, there's a film from the 80s called Missing that's a great film, and I know it's not that. So, Robert writes, tried to watch White Noise and had to tap out after an hour. Oof. Yeah, that happens, Robert. And that was one of my big disappointments from last year. Ray Steele, hopefully future film sociology guest Ray Steele. You'll know why later, friends. The Roberta Flack documentary on American Masters on PBS. Gary writes, Naval Knee was intense. And, oh dear, finally, Allison writes, half of Everything Everywhere All at Once. Couldn't finish it in one setting. It made my brain hurt. I'm sorry, Allison. I'm sorry that my favorite film from last year made your brain hurt. So, get a coffee or something softer or stronger and give the second half another chance. Stay with it. Stay with it, Allison. I think it's worth it. So fingers crossed to you there. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to see some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And thanks for listening. We'll do this again next week. Okay, I want to end this week's show with a little piece of audio that I haven't used on the show in a long time, but it's dedicated to the Golden Globus Theater guys, and because they are doing Blaxploitation Month, Blaxploitation Appreciation History Month. This week they are discussing Blackula. Next week is Trick Baby. Later in the month I will be a guest on the show to discuss Detroit 9000, but a great excuse to play a piece of music from the film, which I used on the film show for in the early years of film sociology. But the title track the theme from Blackula, done by Gene Page. So thanks for listening, and we'll do this again next week. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!